Bom dia, boa tarde ou boa noite. Meu nome é Samuel Ponsoni, eu sou o gestor dos fundos da família Selection aqui na XP e esse é mais um episódio do Outliers, o podcast que traz para vocês aí os mais importantes nomes da indústria de fundos do Brasil e do mundo. Hoje nós temos um convidado muito especial, que é o Jim Haskell. Ele é estrategista de portfólio em um dos maiores hedge funds do mundo, a Bridgewater, que foi fundada pelo Ray Dalio. Além de ser estrategista, o Jim é o responsável pela organização de um dos relatórios diários mais profundos do mercado global, que é uma newsletter chamada Bridgewater Daily Observations. Eu vou pedir 3 minutos para vocês para fazer uma introdução um pouco mais elaborada do episódio de hoje, pois merece, pelo peso da gestora que a gente está recebendo. Quem não quiser ouvir, pode adiantar 3 minutos aí e já ir direto para as perguntas que a gente vai fazer para o Jim. Para aqueles que não conhecem muito bem, a Bridgewater foi fundada pelo Ray Dalio em 1975, em Nova York, como uma empresa mais voltada para gerenciamento de riscos para grandes empresas. E ao longo dos anos evoluiu até se tornar uma das maiores casas voltadas para hedge funds do mundo, que é a versão americana do que a gente conhece como os fundos multimercados aqui no Brasil. Eles possuem cerca de 150 bilhões de dólares sob gestão atualmente, uma cifra gigante. E se for converter para reais aí, com o câmbio de hoje, está dando mais de 800 bilhões de reais. Além de ter fundado e conduzido extremamente bem a Bridgewater por mais de 4 décadas, Ray Dalio também é autor do famoso livro Princípios, um best-seller global aí no mundo das finanças. Como gestora independente e até hoje controlada pelos seus funcionários, a Bridgewater ficou muito famosa pelos retornos auferidos aí ao longo dos anos e também pelos materiais de análise de mercado produzidos por eles, sempre muito profundos. Um desses materiais, ou pelo menos uma temática desses materiais, publicado ali nos anos 90, falou sobre a separação entre o que a gente chama de alfa e beta na hora de se analisar os retornos dos investimentos, algo em que eles foram pioneiros. Eles também espalharam pelo mundo aí e tornaram conhecido o conceito de paridade de risco, também utilizado para fazer gestão. E obviamente eles não se mantiveram somente no campo da pesquisa, como eu acabei de falar aqui, eles colocaram toda essa teoria para trabalhar dentro de 2 grandes estratégias de fundos que eles possuem. Uma chamada Pure Alpha, ou Alpha Puro, numa tradução porca aqui para o português, que é a família de fundos Alpha, e outra família chamada de All Weather, que é a família de fundos Beta, fundos de Beta. All Weather aí remete a um portfólio diversificado o suficiente para conseguir resistir a qualquer ambiente econômico, em tese. Por fim, a gestora entrou muito nos holofotes nos últimos anos pela sua cultura muito única, muito sui generis, que ficou mais explícita depois que o Ray Dalio lançou esse livro aí, o Princípios, em que uma das coisas mais intrigantes é o que eles chamam de transparência radical. E é justamente isso que acontece lá. Basicamente, eles construíram um ambiente de trabalho em que todo mundo fala o que pensa de todo mundo na cara, na lata, o tempo todo. Imaginem só como deve ser trabalhar em um ambiente assim. Todas as reuniões são gravadas, todas, sem exceção. Todas as pessoas são avaliadas o tempo todo, via aplicativos ali, avaliação em real time. Se você está fazendo uma apresentação, todo mundo que está vendo a sua apresentação está te avaliando ali real time e você vê quem está falando o que sobre você. Tem muita coisa surpreendente que eles fazem, totalmente fora da caixinha. Enfim, definitivamente há dezenas de tópicos muito bacanas para cobrir sobre a Bridgewater e o que eles pensam dos mercados. Nós vamos tentar falar um pouquinho sobre alguns desses assuntos nos próximos minutos com o Jim Haskell, que é um baita profissional da Bridgewater, pô, é um cara bem de peso que a gente conseguiu trazer, e tá lá há mais de 18 anos trabalhando com o Ray Dalio e os outros sócios. É um cara que sabe muito da casa. Para me ajudar nesse papo, eu tenho a presença da Carol Oliveira, que é coordenadora de análise de fundos na plataforma da XP, e também o Bernardo Queima, que é sócio da Itajubá, foi para a Bridgewater várias vezes, conhece muito bem eles, e a Itajubá é a empresa que conseguiu trazer a Bridgewater aqui para o Brasil. E nós temos aí uma ótima parceria entre XP e Itajubá hoje na distribuição dos fundos da Bridgewater na plataforma da XP. E no final do episódio, depois que a gente encerrar o papo com o Jim, eu faço 4 perguntas para o Bernardo, em que ele dá mais detalhes sobre todos os fundos da Bridgewater que estão disponíveis no Brasil atualmente. Bom, daqui para frente o episódio original que a gente gravou com o Jim vai ser em inglês, e tem uma outra versão que a gente vai fazer em português, que tem aí uma pessoa que faz a dublagem do Jim. Vamos lá então, pro episódio, bom papo para todo mundo, bom episódio para vocês, e é isso.
Jim, in the name of XP, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Jim, please tell us a little bit about your background and previous experience before joining Bridgewater.
Coming out of college, I really had no interest in finance or investment management or anything of that nature. What I really wanted to do was ultimately become president of the United States, but I thought one good way to do that was to join a research institute that I very much admired called the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. So I got a research assistant position there, but I had wanted to work in the foreign policy realm under Gene Kirkpatrick, who used to be President Reagan's ambassador to the United Nations. But she didn't have any jobs. So they said, well, we do have a job with this guy, John Macon. And John Macon was an economist who I'd never heard of. And to make a long story short, it proved to be a great move because I learned economics through and through. And Macon was a great economist. He ultimately got hired by the chair of the board of the American Enterprise Institute. Macon, because he liked me, hired me up to Caxton. And all of a sudden, I was in the investment management business. And I learned a ton from 1990 to 1994. And then from there, I decided I wanted to go back to graduate school and sort of bring everything I was learning in context. So I went to Harvard's Kennedy School. From there, I ultimately joined Goldman Sachs as on the emerging markets team, the asset management division at that time. And if you remember back in the 1990s, like everything was going on. I mean, you had at Goldman yet, but 1994 was the tequila crisis in Mexico. In 1997, we had the big Asian crisis. And so I was learning like 20 years of experience every year that I was an analyst. And then of course, Russia and LTCM in 1998. And then we had Argentina and Brazil with their exchange rate blow ups. And then ultimately we had the tech, a bubble come down, and all these seemed to be interlinked in some way. And so just a marvelous time, despite the pain of being in that business. And so I was hooked. Eventually, I met Bob Prince, who's one of Bridgewater's co-CIOs, at a conference, and he invited me to come meet Bridgewater investors. And to make a long story short, about a month later, I joined Bridgewater. And at that time, people thought I was crazy, right? Goldman Sachs was sort of at the heyday, and who was this Bridgewater firm? But for me, it felt very, very right. I just was totally enamored with the kind of investment ideas and the quality of the people that I was meeting when I came to Bridgewater. So I made the move, and I've never really looked back.
And regarding now, what is your current role at Bridgewater and which activities are you under your responsibility?
I came in as what was called a portfolio strategist. Now I guess my title is senior portfolio strategist, but about 3-4 years ago, I realized that, you know, the world of podcasting was exploding, right? And still exploding. We had a signature daily publication called the Bridgewater Daily Observations that was every day you would sort of look over the shoulder of a world-class investor and you would know what they were thinking. And it was a great way to engage our clients. I just thought that that publication could use an evolution. And one of those evolutions would be podcasts. So I started to contribute some podcasts. And at first they were very rudimentary and then they started to grow more. And then at the end of last year, 2020, I was asked to oversee that. And so now my responsibilities are senior portfolio strategist, as well as editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations. And I still continue to do all of our podcasts for that publication.
Jim, how were your first weeks and months at Bridgewater? How hard was the adaptation? And how long did you take until you realized it? You would really fit to Bridgewater's culture.
I think everybody that comes into Bridgewater, you know, goes through an adjustment. For me personally, I just felt it was so refreshing. I mean, that's why I came to Bridgewater in part, right? Is that it was a combination of great culture that I really appealed to me and great investment thinking. The transition, you know, took a number of months, but I think for me, it worked very smoothly. And it's the right place for, you know, my DNA. And that is to sort of say what's on your mind and have an open mind to thinking about what are the best ideas before ultimately deciding. And so it was a little bit of a transition because I was coming from an organization that wasn't exactly like that. But having said that, you know, I caught on very quickly. And for me, it was just a matter of months before I felt like this was my home for, you know, hopefully ever. And it's turned out to be a great run. You know, even through ups and downs, it's been a great almost 20 years now.
The report, the Daily Observations, is the origin, is the starting point of the whole history of Bridgewater when it was a research focused company yet. And now you are the chief editor of this very important report. How is this experience for you? What are your main challenges on a daily basis running this newsletter? How is this challenge for you?
Well, it is a big challenge. It's an exciting challenge. I think the first priority that I always keep at the front of my mind is, in order to be differentiating and to continue the success and penetration and engagement of the Bridgewater Daily Observations, our quality of our content has to be extremely high. So the first thing that is always going through my mind is like, are we saying something that is differentiated? Is it high quality? Do I know that I've gotten enough eyes on that, you know, not just my own, that I can really sort of raise the probability that that's true? And so if I do nothing else, that's the first priority. So I have, you know, we call them machines at Bridgewater. I have all these machines to make sure, to the extent that I can, that our quality is really good. And I carefully follow the feedback that I get from our clients and the scoring that they give us to make sure that that's as true as possible. The second thing is, as I think one of the reasons why I'm in the seat is I have kind of a unique perspective. I've been at money, you know, I've actually managed money. I've worked with clients. I've done now the podcast. So I want this to keep evolving. So instead of, you know, we used to, if you go back all the way to the 1970s, this used to come on a telex, and then it came by the fax machine, right? Then for many years, it came by email with a PDF attachment. And now, you know, we've changed that so that we have a whole website called the Bridgewater Client Observatory, and the wire that we call it, that's what we call it internally, you know, that's how it's disseminated. So you get an email, you click on that link, and it goes right to that. And so we want the overall readership experience beyond just the quality of the content to be great. We want the clarity of the communication to be fantastic. We want the right subjects to be covered. What should we be writing about? What shouldn't we be writing about? What should we be talking about? What do our clients want to see? One of the things we've learned is that our clients love to hear differing viewpoints. And so we're trying to bring that to them. And they also like to hear viewpoints of people from outside Bridgewater with our people. So we're increasingly trying to do that as well. And that's been really a lot of fun.
How do you choose the subjects that you're going to share every day? Because one day you're going to talk about inflation in the US. The other day you're going to talk about China. The other day about cryptocurrencies. And you have so many themes to cover. How is it picked?
The first thing is my team has a grid. On one axis are sort of the subject kinds of things we want to hit. So for example, we have talked about the current environment as a monetary policy 3 environment. In other words, if you can't really cut interest rates because they're already at zero, that's a totally different environment than if you could cut interest rates a lot and start another cycle through credit borrowing. MP3 would be one topic, China another topic, and so on. And then we have asset classes. And we have that grid always before us because we want to make sure we're hitting the things that we think are important. And then every day we have different teams of researchers that we meet with. We call them wire councils. If I'm meeting with the fixed income team, we're going to be talking about different ideas, and I'll be interjecting some of these ideas that are from our grid or that came from broader research meetings that we want to follow up on. To the extent possible, it's really important that we always try and make them consistent with what our research projects are, you know, to improve our alpha generation, because that should be in line with what we want to talk about. And so there's like 5 to 6 teams, and I'm meeting with them every day, and we're going over that. And from there, we set our agenda. You know, what can we accomplish over this week? We also try and look at different series. So for example, soon we'll be running a series, you know, everyone talks about the supply chain issues, and the supply chain issues are everywhere. But what we wanted to do is say, okay, let's look at it from an aggregate level, and then let's literally do a 4 or 5 part series on, okay, first there's the energy market, then there's the home market, then there's the semiconductor market, and then the labor market. And what you see is if you do, you know, you can go across or you can go down. And I think the combination of those two things makes it for a very interesting and compelling series for our readers. So we just start to set the agenda out, try and do 3 weeks at a time. And by doing 3 weeks at a time, you know, we obviously know we'll tweak that a little bit as market events come up, but it gives us an ability to have a strategic calendar that's going to be useful. And the last thing I would say is we never forget our customers, right? So we always work through client service and we ask, what are they asking, so that we can incorporate that into our decision-making about what topics to write on.
It's known that in the first 2 or 3 years, a lot of people drop or get fired. Because of the strong culture, pretty much the requirement for excellence must be very high. I would like you to talk a little bit about this, the high turnover, the strong culture of Bridgewater.
If you're going to pursue excellence, not everyone is going to be excellent or stay excellent. And so The first thing is that everyone, when you talk about that in the interview process, will say, of course, I want excellence and so on. Very few will actually mean it, or they won't totally understand it actually means in reality, right? When we say the first sort of 18 months to 2 years, maybe a little bit longer, that's a little bit about not only does a person have the capabilities that we thought they did when we hired them, but also do they have the will? Do they have the overarching attitude, which you can start to test for sustainability of that attitude as well over that period of time, to want to win, to want to be excellent? And I can tell you right now, it's a really hard process. I mean, a lot of people don't really want that in their life. They think they do, but they don't really want that. So, you know, it's hard to tell in the interview process totally. So we're always trying to tweak that to try and get better and higher probability hires. So what we're going to see is that in the first period of time, as you say, like 1 to 3 years, we're going to have pretty significant turnover. I wouldn't call it totally different than industry, maybe a little bit higher than industry. But what's also interesting is after that period of time, the people that stick to Bridgewater are probably way higher than norm. We have many, many people that spend their entire careers at Bridgewater. I think it's because once you really enjoy that, then you tend to want to not go anywhere else.
You mentioned that your DNA fits with Bridgewater. Could you describe to us what kind of professional, what kind of DNA survive or stay in Bridgewater, unique and extreme culture in the long term? If you can just describe some highlights of what kind of person stay in Bridgewater?
All my colleagues, I think, will agree with me that the way that we do things at Bridgewater is that no one is ever comfortable, because they always continuously have the incentives to maintain and enhance their impact. So I think what that lends itself to is a personality that just sort of loves that, right? So it's not even survive. I don't think there really is surviving so much as there is prospering within that type of culture, right? If you like being on edge and love being challenged and constantly trying to reach higher, then I think you're going to have the DNA to love Bridgewater.
Would you mind telling us a short version of Bridgewater's huge story? Maybe starting from the famous episode of creating head structure for McDonald's until the present date.
If you go back to the 1970s, 1975 to be precise, Ray Dalio starts Bridgewater. He didn't have any clients. What he did have was a following of people that thought he was a good researcher. So he starts essentially a consulting business in 1975, right? And it really had no fixed direction. It was like, how can I add value? And one of the ways to do that was the Bridgewater Daily Observations. So that started to catch where, you know, Ray would write his thoughts every day. Maybe it's on an economic report or market movements or just other research he's doing, and share that with his growing number of consulting clients. So I would say the first 10 years of Bridgewater was that. And one of those clients was McDonald's, who was having a difficulty trying to hedge out the very volatile prices of chicken feed that was inherent in their Chicken McNuggets, which was a new product at the time. And so Ray constructed a hedging strategy by selling, you know, chicken feed futures or whatever it was. And this was great for McDonald's because they were able to have more reliability in their pricing. So that was the story from there. But in 1985, two organizations, the World Bank and the Lowe's Corporation, each gave us a small amount of seed money to actually manage money and go from sort of focus and research on the liability side of the balance sheet to the asset side. And so for the next 5 to 6 years, that money was being managed. And there was a tremendous success, by the way, when the stock market collapsed in 1987. And then all that money was given back because, of course, the market rebounded and Bridgewater was still short. So a lot of lessons. Also during that time, a lot of very critical builders were hired. And we would go to like Dartmouth College and we would get this person or that person. They would take this leap of faith and they were help to build the organization and recruit more people because we couldn't compete with Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley and so on. In 1991, we were confident enough to start our flagship strategy, which continues to be the flagship today, which is called Pure Alpha. In the mid-1990s, we introduced All Weather, which was just raised ideas about how to structure the most consistent asset allocation. And then that started to be a product we would offer our clients. So it was very much like that, like thinking through ideas, formulating products around that. The major growth period started in the early 2000s. because that's when our alpha had a good track record by that time, and people wanted that. They were looking at the valuations in the equity market, and they wanted to make sure they had return streams that were less correlated, if not zero correlated, and that's what Bridgewater was offering them. And so from like 2003 to 2000, when I joined, to about 2008, huge growth. And then, of course, we nailed the financial crisis. That was very important to our clients. And then in 2010 and 11, you know, understanding how quantitative easing worked, we just nailed it. And so the reputation of the firm just kept going and going and going. And then over the last number of years, you know, our alpha hasn't been as good, although we think we understand why now. So that modern iteration has been sort of managing pure alpha, managing all weather, getting more into China. So we have an all weather China strategy now, things like that. Today, our clientele is just so admirable. It's just these wonderful pools of capital around the world. We have relationships down in Brazil, which we never used to have. We have relationships in other new markets for us. And it's been a great, great experience across time.
How was the transition from the investment consulting firm to a hedge fund or investment firm?
The transition, you know, many of the ideas that would be sort of work on the liability side about how to hedge risk and so on. I mean, these ideas can be translated to the asset side, but I think the key difference is that when you're managing money, you should expect to make mistakes all the time. Right? Because the markets discount the future. And so if you think about all the participants that are buying and selling, setting price, and that price discounts the future, you have to have an edge on that market pricing in order to make money from there, from an alpha point of view. So that means that, like, we very, you know, very early on realized that we were going to make a lot of mistakes, and the process of making those mistakes can be quite painful. As I mentioned to you, the example of post 1987, when we gave back all the gains we made in the stock market crash of 1987. So this is how sort of diversification became embedded in our bones, that yes, we're going to make mistakes. The question is, do you win more than you lose? And if you win more than you lose and you know how to control the downside, that's going to be a really good way to manage money. So I would say that from a fundamental understanding, you know, the root cause of why markets move, there really was no change per se. I'm sure we learned more as time went on. But in terms of the lessons about how to convert your understanding to a successful money manager, that I think took some time. And between 1985 and 1991, when we learned, you know, launched Pure Alpha, I think we learned a ton. We basically realized we had to be as diversified as possible while still having an edge market by market. And when we structured Pure Alpha, that's why we structured it that way. So I think by then we learned how to become money managers, but quite a big adjustment from being sort of a consultant to actually having risk on every day.
I would like to ask you about the unique culture of Bridgewater. I think that's one of the things that draws more the attention of anyone who reads about Bridgewater. How does it work, the meritocracy of ideas and the radical transparency concepts applied to the asset management world?
The idea of idea meritocracy and radical transparency, and this is why Ray wrote the principles, that can be broadly applied in many, many businesses. Okay, but for the asset management business, it's been a great set of principles to apply because of the competitive nature of that. And so how does it work? Depending on what you're talking about, right, there's so many issues and so many decisions that need to be made. And when you're making, if everything was so obvious, right, then, you know, it wouldn't be a very competitive business. Our general modus operandi is to get people together that have believability in that because they have experience, and talk about the pros and the cons of those issues and get all those ideas up on the table. And so part of the responsibility about working at Bridgewater is that you can't just sit back. You know, people that just sit back and don't take risks about what those ideas are don't get rewarded. So we want people to bring out those ideas, even if only 30% of them, 20% of them are good ideas. We wouldn't have those 20% unless they're proactive about submitting them. And then we bat them around and we judge. And so as you're doing any decision making, as you weigh the pros and cons of different decisions, the more ideas you have on the table, the more information you have on the table, the better your decision making is going to be. So that's what we mean by the idea meritocracy. At the end of the day, someone needs to decide. We call that person the responsible party. But the responsible party is not in their position unless they're good at taking input from multiple sources to be able to weigh that thing effectively. And so that's how it works, right? We also use tools, like I'm sure you've heard about some of these. We will stop and we'll stop a meeting, for example, and we have this thing called the DOT system. I mean, I guess there's two ways to think about this. One is poll questions. So instead of just going around and having people pontificate, once people put their ideas on the table, we will stop the meeting and everyone can go to an app on their computer and someone can enter in the poll question. Should we do X, yes or no? Or what's the magnitude of your conviction for doing X, you know, the issue is. And then you can see real time what people think. You can start to probe deeper into why they believe what they do. So there's a little bit about the law of large numbers here, because you can include more people, even some of the people that aren't participating in the actual discussion, but maybe participating by Zoom, or maybe participating at the outer edges of the room, or what have you. They may not have the experience that, let's say, a longer tenured person would, but they have a view. So you can actually see the outliers and go test those views as well. The other element of it is, if I'm in a meeting, everyone will be required to put in what we call dots. And there's all these different attributes, things like pursuit of excellence, ownership mentality, organized and reliable, ability to synthesize, integrity, you know, all sorts of different types of characteristics. So we'll look at each person's performance in a meeting and we'll ask our people to rate other people in terms of what they thought. When you get, again, the law of large numbers, you can get really interesting feedback. And one of the big things about our culture is that you have to be open to feedback. You have to want that feedback, because the feedback is the medicine, it's the juice for innovation, for improvement, again, all in the search of excellence. And so again, going back to your cultural DNA, those people that want that, they're going to be the ones that prosper at Bridgewater.
And Jim, talking about the people structure of Bridgewater, I would like to know how many people are inside of the investment team, including research, trading, and portfolio management. How are they divided?
About 300 work there. The majority of the firm is our investment engine and our client service, which is the two key parts of our value added, right? Our returns and the advice that we give to our clients. Those two things would be the predominance, and then everything else is enablement of those two functions.
Do you guys are divided by region, by markets? For example, in Brazil, it's very, very common formation is we have a trading desk dedicated to currencies, another one dedicated to rates, another one dedicated to Brazilian stocks, and so on. How is it at Bridgewater?
We have an equity team. We have a fixed income team. We have an emerging markets team, which is a bit different. We have a commodities team, and so on and so on. But at the same time, the way we organize ourselves is we have pretty much daily research huddles. So at 9 o'clock in the morning, we will have subjects that will cross cut these teams. We will rotate our researchers around those teams, and we will create surge projects, which can be cross dimensional. So for example, if we want to know how something works, like MP3, what we're calling monetary policy 3, that will include elements of multiple teams onto that. So even though we have the organization of teams, we will assign people to work on sort of quasi new teams that on a particular project.
I want to move to the next part, talk about investment process and how the strategy of the funds work. Many people say that Bridgewater is purely quantitative. And in the book, Principles, Ray Dalio describes it as the union of man and machine. Could you talk about it and explain how does it affect the portfolio construction, the trades, the rebalancing? What did he mean by that?
It's the biggest mistake in the world to think that Bridgewater is a quantitative investment manager. We are not. The three planks of our investment philosophy are fundamental. That's the first one, which literally means identifying the true cause and effect relationships in markets. What are the causal drivers of markets? And I want to distinguish that between quantitative, because quantitative usually means looking back and making sense of what happened through quantitative methods. We don't personally think that's reliable. We think the way to think about it is to understand the logic first of what the cause and effect relationship is. And then you can go back and look at that across analogous times and across countries, okay? And see, does that hold out or not? I'm convinced that by doing it that way, we lower the risk of sort of trying to make sense of what did happen without really understanding the logic, which is where many quantitative firms have gotten in trouble. So fundamental is big. Then there is where the confusion lies, because the second plank is systematic. How do we then take that fundamental logic and develop measuring tools so that every day we can take the fundamental thing we would have done if we were discretionarily doing it, right? And measure that relationship country by country by country, asset by asset by asset. And that systemization is what Ray means by sort of creating a machine out of our fundamental thinking. And once we do that, once we convert our fundamental thinking into those systems, now our ability to construct the portfolio will be much simpler because we can know what we think about any particular market by how mispriced it is by virtue of processing all of that. And then we can construct a portfolio of a diversified, which is our third plank, set of return streams, right? When we put them together, it's how good do we think each one is over time? And then how unrelated are they in terms of how much space they get in the risk budget? And so that's what we do. And we have people overseeing those systems. And then literally what we're trying to do is evolve those systems over time. Where can we be better in those systems? You know, how can we measure better? But all the decisions about how we evaluate the markets have already been made.
Regarding the framework, you know, Bridgewater is famous about the framework, how you look the markets, the cash returns, beta, alpha. Can you describe a little bit how this approach, how this framework, how they was designed and how was implemented in terms of managing money and the strategies, how this is connected with your philosophy of investing money?
Well, the idea of fundamental, systematic, and diversified is really, it's an overall philosophy we have, but it can really be applied mostly to alpha, right? Now you're talking about how to think about an overall portfolio. This is, we do a lot of this as well. So this all, you know, came back to Ray and our people thinking through at a base level, what is a portfolio? And so the first step is if you have cash in your pocket and you give up that cash, you wouldn't logically give up that cash unless you felt you were going to get paid more than what you have in your pocket, right? Ultimately. So you give up the comfort of having that liquidity in your pocket that you could spend. And what you're hoping for is you're going to get even more spending power in the future. And that's what we call a risk premium, right? But even in alpha sense, where there's no risk premium, you would invest in skill. Somebody will navigate the markets to be able to offer you returns greater than the cash you just gave up. So then there are really two different types of return streams, right? And, you know, once you give up that cash, there's two different types of return streams. If you just invested passively in the markets, bonds, stocks, whatever, commodities, whatever it may be, that is one kind. And then that gives you a certain level of characteristics. Asset classes over time have to have risk premiums because if they didn't, people would catch on and just hoard cash, right? If you never got rewarded by taking on risk, then people wouldn't take on risk because you would only get the pain and you wouldn't get the reward. By taking on asset exposure, you're getting a certain amount of risk premium. And the question then becomes, how can you diversify that in a way to get the most stable and best return you can? And then on the alpha side, that's just manager skill, right? They either like stocks, they don't like stocks. They like this currency, they don't like that currency. They like this bond market, they don't like that bond market. So they go long or they go short and they develop returns or losses from their trading. That's a very different type of return stream than beta, which is what I first was talking about with the passive allocation to assets. So when you look at an overall portfolio, really the decision is, it comes down to this: how much cash do I want? What does that earn you? Today, basically zero in the developed world. How much do you get from just holding cash? And then what is your excess returns from holding beta and alpha? And it's very important, since most strategies come coupled together, to decouple them and understand how good is someone at generating alpha when it's really a zero-sum game. There's going to be winners and there's going to be losers. And how good are they at just getting beta? And are they paying for the right things? Right? And then how is their beta constructed? Is it diversified enough? How's their alpha constructed? Is it diversified enough? Those are the portfolio construction principles that add up to the overall portfolio. And I would say Bridgewater has been very successful over many, many years of really sort of teaching these principles and showing our clients how much more powerful it can be for their own money management if they adopt those principles in their own money management, because it will enable them to have more robust return streams by understanding them better.
Let's talk about ESG. Regarding sustainability, congratulations on the launch of your recent sustainability venture, which you are helping our clients to understand the space and invest in it. How does Bridgewater integrate a sustainable approach into its investment philosophy? How is it possible to escalate sustainable investing globally and covering different asset classes.
One of the things to make clear is when we are engaged in sustainable investing, we're doing so at the behest of our clients. One of the things that we feel strongly about is that we ourselves can't make value judgments for others, but we respond to the needs of our clients. And we know that there's great demand from Europe, from many places around the world for a third dimension in investing, not just risk, not just return, but also impact. And so when we're going to part our, you know, going through our research process and where we're offering a sustainable strategy, we're looking at the same things that we always look at with that third lens, which is impact. And the impact that we use, we wouldn't, again, not trying to put our values on it, but just utilizing neutral ratings like the United Nations. So if we talk about, for example, how to construct the best beta, that would be our all-weather strategy. But for clients that want to structure an asset allocation strategy that also has that third lens of impact, we will then apply that, filter out the securities that would then be in versus out, and construct that same asset allocation, but with that third dimension.
You guys have around $70 billion in the pure alpha strategy, which is the alpha family, and around $60 billion, a little bit more, in the all-weather strategy, which is the beta family. How do you guys build both portfolios? Do you guys have a team dedicated to pure alpha, another team dedicated to all-weather? Do you guys have the same positions in both funds?
Alpha and beta are totally different. What we want to do with our beta strategy is we want to understand the fundamental characteristics of each asset class. How do nominal bonds work? How do equities work? And if we understand the characteristics of those assets and specifically how they relate to the two big conditions, the change continuously, growth and inflation, then we can structure an asset allocation that is sort of, we're just rebalancing to that, right? It's a long only strategy, rebalancing to that, that will give us the steadiest way, the most consistent way of extracting risk premiums from markets and therefore getting the most consistent returns. Notice I never said the best returns. The best returns are always going to be the portfolios that are dominated in risk by the best performing asset. And so for the last number of years, that's been equities. But there's many years where equities is the worst performing asset, right? So it's not, it's the most consistent. The only time where that portfolio wouldn't be as consistent within a range is if cash is preferred over all risky assets, which can happen. Think about the early 1980s in the developed world. So that will affect, of course, all assets and so on. But most times, if it's simply just growth and inflation changing, then the most consistent performance will be diversifying across assets with different growth and inflation characteristics in a good way. That will be better than any single concentrated portfolio over time, maybe not at a point in time. Alpha is a totally different game. The only really similarity is that you have to understand the characteristics of what drives this market, you know, what drives bonds, what drives equities, and so on. And then you have to compare your sense of conditions for those drivers relative to what the market's already discounting. That's alpha, right? You have to understand the root cause and effect, understand what drives the markets, have insight, have an edge, compare your sense of conditions every day to what the market's already discounting. Because you can have the greatest insight in the world, but if you agree with what the market's discounting, you have no trade to make money. So it has to be relative to what the markets are expecting with no bias to up or down. And if you have that, that's alpha. And the advantage of alpha is if you can spot it and if it's good, it can give you uncorrelated returns to the rest of the portfolio. So that's why we separate it out. Because if it was just like beta, there's no advantage to separating it out. But by separating it out and identifying good uncorrelated alpha, you're now diversifying the portfolio in a much more significant way.
The teams dedicated to both strategies, is it the same team or you have separate teams?
Same team, because Okay. Once the beta is, it takes a lot of research, but once you have it set up, now all you have to do is rebalance. You have to have rebalancing methodologies and so on. Whereas alpha, we're setting up systems, you know, essentially our logic, our investment logic, measuring those every day relative to what the market's discounting. And then that will either be long or short market by market. And then we're automatically running that in our portfolio construction group, you know, and implementing that into a series of trades. And that's very dynamic and will change in terms of the positions that we have.
Regarding 2020, it was a tough year for some investors. And you mentioned that also for your alpha part. a little bit and sometimes for the beta part. What happened in 2020 and what does it mean and what your view about the COVID and all the crisis that we suffered last year and still suffering somehow in some parts of the world?
That whole set of events probably tested Bridgewater more than we've ever been tested because we were losing money. We had to quickly understand how that fiscal was going to flow through around the world and how the quantitative easing was going to match up with that in a world where it wasn't really the financial sector that was at risk. It was just the economy was cratering due to a pandemic. So how was that going to work? That meant that the innovation that occurred in what I call the MP3 environment, where it's really about fiscal with the monetary policy monetizing, meaning they're the ones printing money and buying the bonds increasingly, that was going to work in a totally different way. And the last time we really saw was the 1940s during the war. And yet we really had to understand that and how it was going to flow through and ultimately. And the great news is that even though the world has been in tumult, we at Bridgewater have also, of course, had our own personal things dealing with the pandemic, but we have been able to innovate to, I think, understand how this works quickly enough. And now we're starting to see those results play out. We're cautiously, you know, humble and affirming that to see that it continues. And I think if it is, we're in great shape. Think about this. The last time we went from an environment that was really good where there's equity concentration to a completely opposite environment was the 1970s, and it was a terrible decade. The problem is that investors don't understand when things are good. They're not good at looking out. If they don't understand the root causes of why things are good and the vulnerabilities of that, they don't adjust to the next decade in time, and therefore their portfolios are very volatile. And so what we're trying to do here is educate what we can to say, hey, the next 10 years are likely to be nothing like the last 10, and you better get prepared today. And here's what's how it works and what you would likely need to do. And that's what Bridgewater is all about.
Looking ahead and at a high level, what do you think are the biggest risks that investors face today?
Inflation. I think inflation is the biggest risk. There's tons of risks, right? So inflation's a big one. And by the way, they're interrelated in many ways. But I also think we are at a big risk of political tumult. You know, think about the developed world, right? We see political risk historically, and we tend to think if you lived in the developed world that, you know, in the emerging world, that's where the political risk lies. But the truth is that the political risk is probably most acute right now in the developed world. And I don't say that pejoratively, but, you know, when I say the developed world, I mean just, you know, the big countries. In the United States, we're at polar opposites, and it's very hard to get to a middle where you can actually get intelligent legislation. If you look at Europe, I think many of those problems are also now existing. So there's not that anchor. There's not that anchor in the way there was either in the Cold War or where there was post-Cold War for a while with the United States being the dominant power. And now you have a rising power in China. So I think there's a lot of, and a big flashpoints all over in Taiwan and so on. There's a lot of political risk that I think investors need to account for beyond inflation. And of course, inflation is connected in that if you get higher inflation, then that raises the political risk. Those are particular things. I think the environment is another one. I think social media, by the way, is aggravating all of these tensions in ways that aren't always helpful. So these are some of the risks that I think are going to confront us.
Could you elaborate a little bit more about inflation? All the central banks are saying it is transitory. What is Bridgewater's opinion?
I have the utmost respect for central banks, but central banks have a job and goals. And historically, if you go back and look at what central banks have said and what has happened, those are often not consistent. So let me just say that. So let's have a healthy level of skepticism for what central banks said. It is in their total interest to say that inflation is transitory, of course, because they want to keep the anchor on financial asset pricing. They don't want a crisis on their watch. But I don't think it is transitory. I think that what we have right now is overwhelming demand as a result of big, big fiscal expansion. I mean, people lose track of how many trillions of dollars have been spent and the effect and how fiscal policy works. So it has raised incomes. And it is also, I think, part of the supply problems because, like, for example, in the United States, we had over 4 million people leave their jobs in August. In certain, you know, we have restaurants that don't open on certain days because they can't get labor. And part of that is because with government supports, you know, if I have a choice between collecting a check and working hard in a kitchen or something that's not very glamorous, I'll choose the check. right? And there's other problems associated with the pandemic and so on. But the big problem is that the demand is just too much for the supply, and the supply can't keep up. And whenever the supply can't keep up, then you're always going to have bottleneck problems. And that leaves the central banks in a very peculiar and difficult position, because they always have the power to eliminate the demand. But if they did that, they would be more unpopular than they even are today, and probably would see their independence they have left, because it's one stroke away of the pen of eliminating that. I'm being a little exaggerating for, you know, to be provocative, but you can see what I mean. So I think the inflation, now the inflation's a real risk also, because most portfolios are concentrated in equity and equity-like assets, and those assets don't tend to do well with sustained changes in inflation. I worry about what asset returns are gonna mean in that space, and I worry what that will mean for broader institutional portfolios or for private portfolios that are, you know, need to be managed for retirement purposes and so on. That's a big risk. And it can be very tumultuous once the market psychology changes, because you're not only are you in equity heavy positions, but there's also illiquid equity kind of positions that have grown as people have searched for yield in a zero interest rate world. And that also presents even more risk, because then investors sell what they can, not what they can't. And what they can is going to be in the public space.
Talking about the risk of the loss of US dollar relative value compared to other major currencies, what is the Bridgewater's view on this topic?
First of all, the strategic position of the United States dollar has been a boon for the United States. It's a major advantage. The capital markets are deepest here. The innovation is highest in the United States. So there's reasons for why the dollar should be, you know, the world's reserve currency. On the other hand, the indebtedness in the United States is off the charts. We have a rising power in China that's trying to open up their capital markets. And you really can't service the amount of debt that the United States has in real dollars, which means you've either got to default, which is unthinkable in actual explicit default terms, or you have to implicitly default by printing the dollars ultimately to satisfy the debt servicing claims. And this is all, by the way, at current interest rates. Imagine if interest rates rose, right? So if you think, well, if interest rates rise, this whole thing comes down very quickly. So and then interest rates can't rise. Well, who's the player that can keep them from rising? And you come back to the central bank, which is why the inflation is likely to be more sustained going forward, because that the inflation is the way to bring the debt stock down. It's painful, but probably less painful than the alternative, right? Germany did it in the 1920s after the World War I reparations, and we've seen, you know, multiple other countries do it as well. Now, the question then is, are the other countries in a different position such that the dollar would fall against other currencies? Not necessarily. I mean, all these developed countries are basically indebted very highly. And for that matter, so is China. China has more room to cut interest rates than these other countries do. But I'm just saying that it's not necessarily a devaluation of the dollar against these other currencies. That's a bigger question. I think it's mostly a devaluation of fiat currency against stuff, right? But generally speaking, when you get a sustained inflation, you're getting a debasement of fiat currency and a revaluation of real assets. And I think that's the period that is starting to poke its head into the environment.
You, Bridgewater, has a special view about the tech bubble.
You know, the only thing we wanted to point out about the tech bubble is that there are tech companies without a lot of earnings that appear to us by our systematic way of evaluating bubbles to be in a bubble, okay? And I would differentiate that to other broader aspects of the market. There's a big difference in, even in the US equity market. I think that what you're saying is right, that there are aspects of the technology sector that we do think are in a bubble, and I don't think have good longer term returns expected. It shouldn't be have good longer term expected returns. There's also a lot of innovation in the tech sector and so on. So it's an exciting sector, but with cheap money, it's also being bid up and creating a threshold to beat in terms of earnings for it to pay off. And that's really difficult to do.
China. Bridgewater has a profound knowledge about China, pretty much influenced by Ray Dalio's admiration for the country. Are you concerned with the recent developments in the country, especially in the real estate sector, but also in the education sector, in the games sector? The government has been moving around, a lot of sectors intervening. Is it a concern for you guys? How do you guys see
China right now?
First of all, I would say it's definitely meriting strong attention, because the important thing when these things go on, whether it's Evergrande or some of the other sectors, is what is the intent of policy? How is it being managed? And I think our basic synthesis here is that China is not trying to shut down capitalism, far, just the reverse, meaning that their form of capitalism is something they want to promote more and more. They want to open up their capital markets. They understand that in order to attract capital, you have to have some form of capitalism. But it is not necessarily the form of capitalism that the West enjoys or participates in. I don't want to make a value statement one way or the other. It's a different type of capitalism. It's one where the state has to have their interests satisfied. You know, without being a China expert, the Chinese are worried about wealth inequality. They have different ways. They want to make sure that the party remains in control. They want to make sure that the government remains in control. And from there, then businesses can flourish or not flourish as they see fit. And so I think that one of the problems here is that there's often a certain intent that's not understood on the other side. And that creates problems and I think also assumptions that may not be correct. Our basic thinking is that China wants to open up. It wants to be a superpower. It wants to do that militarily, economically, but it doesn't have the exact same values as the United States does. And so it's going to make decisions top down that they think are in the country's interest. Now, if I'm structuring an asset allocation today, that raises the question of whatever your view on China is, does that mean that China should be in a global portfolio? Because let's say my view is even like, well, I'm not sure what the intent is of the Chinese. If I were to think about the differences that Chinese assets offer me relative to other assets around the world, I think there's a very compelling case that it should be part of a global portfolio. It has much lower valuations. It has higher risk premiums. It has higher interest rates, so that in the event of a downturn, the ability to cut interest rates is there where the West doesn't have it. And the alternatives are Europe with zero interest rates, the United States with near zero interest rates, Japan with zero interest rates that don't have a lot of room to cut and that are sort of feeling the constraints of inflationary pressure. So if you're looking for sort of the most consistent portfolio, you have to kind of drop all the labels and think about what are the characteristics of the return streams. And from that perspective, I do think that China belongs in a global portfolio. Think about it as a balanced, you know, mix of assets in China, stocks and bonds do belong in a global portfolio.
How you are dealing with all these risks, inflation, dollar, China, tech, equity, all things that you mentioned in your beta and alpha portfolio.
Where we see opportunities right now is we're long commodities. We have been long for commodities, and that's really starting to pay off. We're long break-even inflation. So that's the, you know, if you're long inflation-linked bonds and short nominal bonds, that creates a break-even position that allows you to essentially benefit if expectations of inflation keep rising as they have been. We're now short U.S. stocks, which is dominated by tech, and longer other markets that have better valuations. When we look at our portfolio today, I think, you know, a lot of the themes that I've talked about are embedded in some of these positions. But to keep a highly diversified portfolio, we also have other positions, differential positions, relative value positions that are not as directional and are diversifying to the overall alpha portfolio. And then from an overall portfolio construction point of view, you have to look at aggregate risks, right? So you're going to obviously look at risks in each market, but then you have to look at the overall amount of risk. And we do this all the time. And we just want to make sure that, you know, for example, when our views are strong as they are right now, that the overall amount of value at risk that you're taking in a portfolio is contained to a certain level. So sometimes you got to ramp down your views a little bit because you have so many strong views market by market. Other times, by the way, you have to add some risk at the overall portfolio level because your views might be weaker. Right now we're at the stronger part. So you have to keep that and you have to simulate back. This is what I mean by like systematically simulating back. What, when our views were really this strong, what were the range of outcomes that we experienced from an actual volatility point of view? Incorporating that into how you're setting positions today.
Jen, I think we have arrived to our final questions here. So I would like to ask you, after 18 years working in an environment like Bridgewater's, do you think you would be able to work in any traditional company again?
No, not a traditional company. No, I could not do that. You know, I'm in my mid-50s now, although I hope I look a lot younger. I try and keep in shape, but I'm in my mid-50s. I think that it would never be a traditional company, and it may never be anything else than Bridgewater. If I did something, it would have to be sort of something completely different or at a small sort of at my own pace type of thing. But there's no way, if you're thriving at Bridgewater, in my view, there's no way that you would go work for a traditional company. It just wouldn't work. You just, I don't know how, why you would do that or how you could tolerate that. No, I think that the open environment, the dynamism, the excitement, and the radical sort of idea sharing, transparency, and search for excellence is one of the things that's kept me here for so long. And I can't imagine giving that up.
During your professional life, you pretty much received at least one or two great lessons about investing, which you consider very valuable and like to teach to interns or junior analysts or your relatives. I don't know. What would be that lesson or lessons?
One of them we already talked about, so I'll leave that, which is diversification is everything. Okay? So properly diversifying and reliably diversifying. The second one is, I think, more interesting because it's newer here. And that came from Bruce Kovner way back when. And he showed me that most people, most traders, will not let their winners run long enough. That they will take those winners off the table way too soon, trying to consolidate gains and almost fantasizing about why conditions are changing when they're not. So allowing your winners to run is a big lesson. While getting rid of your losers before they hurt you for too long is also part of that.
Jim, are you reading any specific book currently? If yes, which book is that? Would you recommend it or not?
I'm enjoying a book because I think it's very important for what's going on. It's called The Coddling of the American Mind. And so much is going on in our university system and beyond in terms of sort of the opposite of what we're trying to preach at Bridgewater. So at Bridgewater, we want as many different perspectives as we can. So, you know, we believe in a highly diverse workforce. And at the same time, part of an idea meritocracy is exposing and having the courage to expose your ideas to scrutiny. And The Coddling of the American Mind is essentially showing how the university system is doing exactly the opposite and what the repercussions of that are. So I find it very interesting because I think the more it happens, the more society will be troubled because the graduates of our universities go into the workforce and then, you know, we don't have the right kind of tension that one needs for great decision making. So I highly suggest it to all of your clients. It's, as you can see, by Greg Lukianoff and Jonathan Haidt, and it's on the New York Times bestseller, at least it was, and it's quite good.
Jim, the name of XP, the name of Itajubá here with us. Thank you very much for your time again. It was a great episode, I can tell you. And I hope we meet soon personally in Westport whenever COVID allows us. And thank you.
Great to be with you.
Thank you, Jim. Take care.
Thank you, Jim.
Bom, pessoal, fim da nossa conversa com o Jim. A gente preferiu não gastar tanto tempo restrito dele para perguntar detalhes de produtos da Bridgewater. Eu preferi chamar o Bernardo Queima, da Itajubá, para fazer algumas perguntas suplementares e tentar explicar melhor sobre as estratégias dos fundos que estão disponíveis aí na XP. Hoje a XP tem 5 produtos da Bridgewater disponíveis na plataforma. O primeiro tem o nome de Gamma Bridgewater Global Risk Premium, que é a estratégia all-weather tradicional da casa. Esse fundo só possui a versão com exposição cambial aqui no Brasil, ou seja, está sujeito à variação dos ativos do fundo e também sujeito à variação da cotação do dólar contra o real. E ele tem um público-alvo mais restrito, que são investidores profissionais. A segunda estratégia que a XP trouxe para a plataforma é um mix do All Weather com o Pure Alpha e se chama Lixor Bridgewater Core Global Macro. O nome comprido aqui não ajuda tanto. Ele está disponível tanto na versão sem exposição cambial quanto na versão dolarizada, e esse fundo tem mais ou menos 50% do risco alocado na estratégia do All Weather e 50% alocado na estratégia do Pure Alpha. contando aí a versão com exposição cambial e a sem exposição cambial, são dois produtos a mais. Por fim, a terceira alternativa de estratégia que a XP trouxe para a plataforma é uma versão especial do All Weather, chamada All Weather Sustainability, disponível também tanto na versão com exposição cambial quanto na versão sem exposição ao dólar aí. São mais duas opções aqui então, que somam no total as cinco alternativas que eu havia mencionado. Bernardo, de maneira resumida, explica aí com as suas palavras para a gente qual que é a estratégia de investimentos do Gamma Bridgewater Global Risk Premium, que é a estratégia All Weather. E depois também aí com as suas palavras, explica para a gente o que é o fundo All Weather Sustainability, qual que é a diferença dele para o All Weather tradicional, por favor.
O All Weather é o fundo de Asset Allocation da Bridgewater. É um grande multimercado global long only que opera mais de 70 mercados. E ele foi construído inicialmente para os recursos pessoais do Ray Dalio. Né? O objetivo era criar um fundo que fosse resiliente o suficiente para navegar em diferentes cenários econômicos. E eles fizeram isso de uma forma muito inovadora e pioneira na época, porque esse fundo nasceu em 96, que foi focar a construção desse fundo alocando o risco e não o capital em quatro cenários diferentes. Surpresas positivas e negativas de inflação, surpresas positivas e negativas de crescimento. Por isso que ele tem esse nome de All Weather. E o fundo vem entregando, desde o seu início, retornos ao redor de 8, com o objetivo de volatilidade de 12. O All Weather Sustainability, ele tem o mesmo modelo de investimento, que tem esse histórico de mais de 25 anos, mas com um filtro adicional de itens de sustentabilidade. Essa sustentabilidade, esses itens de sustentabilidade, a Bridgewater buscou a fonte de inspiração na ONU, nos 17 Objetivos de Desenvolvimento Sustentáveis da ONU, que foram ratificados por mais de 190 países. Tá? A ideia desse fundo é ter exatamente uma boa relação, como o All Weather tem, de risco e retorno, mas também um portfólio mais alinhado do que os portfólios tradicionais em relação ao mundo mais sustentável. Nesse mandato em específico, você tem ali um objetivo de volatilidade de 8, diferente do All Weather, né, de 12, um pouco menos de vol, e objetivo de retorno na casa de 5 em dólar.
Vamos para a nossa segunda pergunta aqui, Bernardo. Como que funciona a estratégia do Pure Alpha, que compõe ali metade do risco do Lyxor Core Global Macro?
A estratégia Pure Alpha Major Markets é uma estratégia que busca, como o próprio nome fala, trazer ao investidor o alpha. O que significa o alpha? O alpha é aquilo que você extrai do mercado, né? São os retornos adicionais aos índices, e a Bridgewater busca fazer isso de forma bastante descorrelacionada com esses mercados. Por isso a ideia de Pure Alpha Major Markets é a ideia de você extrair um alpha que realmente agregue para o portfólio dos investidores. E como é que isso é feito na prática? É uma abordagem fundamentalista, muita gente estudando e compreendendo as relações de causa e efeito dos principais mercados e aplicado de forma muito disciplinada, sistematicamente, diversificado ao extremo, que são os três grandes pilares da Bridgewater. Fundamentalismo, muito estudo, sistematização e diversificação. Na prática, isso é feito operando sem direção previamente definida, podendo estar comprado ou vendido nos mercados de moedas, bonds, bolsa e commodities. O Pure Alpha Major Market faz isso operando mais de 50 a 70 mercados, os mais líquidos do mundo.
Terceiro ponto que eu separei aqui, Bernardo, queria falar sobre performance. Qual que é a performance histórica de cada uma dessas estratégias em termos de retorno anualizado? E qual que é a volatilidade que eles apresentaram de fato aí ao longo dos seus períodos de existência?
Todos os fundos estão entregando retornos alinhados com o objetivo inicial de cada um, mas os últimos anos foram melhores do que a média, em particular para o All Weather, com retornos na casa de 10 em dólar no ano de 2020 e nesse ano de 2021, diferente do seu objetivo de 8% ao ano. A estratégia mais líquida do Pure Alpha Major Market entrega retornos anualizados de dólar mais 13 desde novembro de 2010, quando foi lançado. A volatilidade do produto do Pure Alpha Major Markets desde o início está na casa de 11%. O All Weather Sustainability ele foi lançado recentemente, em junho desse ano, e pretende entregar com volatilidade de 8, o Sharpe, como eu já falei, entre 0,5 e 0,6. Ele segue a mesma filosofia os 25 anos de histórico do Alweather, e as simulações indicam, com todos os disclaimers para a questão de simulações, que ele pode performar melhor do que o Alweather por conta das questões dos filtros de sustentabilidade. E por fim, a estratégia combinada do Pure Alpha Major Markets com o Alweather, que é o Core Global Macro, que está na plataforma da XP, é bem mais nova. Ela foi lançada no final de 2019. Mais nova, eu digo, com relação aos grandes históricos, longos históricos do Pure Alpha e do Alweather, que são da década de 90. Ela foi lançada em setembro de 2019. E o fundo teve um ano bastante difícil em 2020, né, rendendo negativamente na casa de 2,7. Mas esse ano ele está subindo ao redor de 6% até o final de outubro, tá? Com volatilidade ao redor nos últimos 12 meses de 7%, um pouco abaixo da sua vol, que a Bridgewater espera ficar ao redor de 9%.
Última pergunta aqui, os materiais sobre os fundos estão disponíveis em português para qualquer investidor ou só para os alocadores e distribuidores que são considerados como profissionais?
Sim, Samuel, todos os materiais estão em português e os fundos estão disponíveis no site da XP, os fundos e os seus materiais. Sobre os investidores alvos dos fundos, o Lixor Core Global Macro e o Alweather Sustainability são destinados a investidores qualificados, enquanto o Gamma Bridgewater Global Risk Premium, que é o Alweather, ele é somente para investidores profissionais, que, como a gente mencionou anteriormente, são aqueles investidores que ou precisam de certificação ou que necessitam de patrimônio superior a 10 milhões de reais.
Bom, Bernardo, muito obrigado pelos esclarecimentos. Acho que assim a gente fica com um episódio bem, bem mais completo. E espero que os nossos ouvintes tenham aprendido bastante aí sobre essa gestora tão interessante que é a Bridgewater. Pessoal, forte abraço para vocês e até a próxima!